right, I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon, and my name is Angie. My home group is the A Little Time for Myself group in Point Washington, Florida, and I live right down the street in Destin, Florida. I bring you greetings from my group. They invite you to please come and join us anytime you're down our way. We have a lot of fun, as I'm sure your home group does as well. I'd like to thank the board, and I'd like to thank Scott and Jan for inviting Chip and I to come. This is just such a beautiful place. I've just been amazed at how beautiful it is, so we can't wait to have a little time to enjoy some of it this afternoon. I heard somebody say one time that Al-Anon is all about relationships, and I would agree that it is about relationships, but also for me it's been a lot about hope, and it's been a lot about miracles, and I hope to be able to share a few of those with you this morning. I was raised in a military family. My dad was an Army officer, so that meant we were always moving, thinking about moving, wondering where we're going to live next, packing, unpacking. That was just the way of life. My father was not an alcoholic. He truly was a social drinker. There are such people. And the few times in my life I saw him, what we would call in my family, a little tipsy, he would come in from a military event, and he would go over to the phone, and he would get his old address book out and call some of his old Army buddies, and they would reminisce on the phone about stories from the military. And I loved it when that would happen because my dad talked very, very little about his military life. So I got to hear some of it on those phone conversations. So it was great fun to me. My mother was an alcoholic, and she was pretty physically abusive to me growing up. So she and I had a pretty tumultuous relationship there for a while. I have a brother, Glenn, who's 7 years older than I am. And Glenn, when I was born, he was already kind of out of the house because he excelled at every sport that involved a ball. He was also a math and science genius. He was the quarterback on the football team and the pitcher on the baseball team and the forward on the basketball team and whatever you were on the golf league and the bowling league. And I mean, he was out there doing it. His math and science skills really helped him with the trajectory of any kind of ball, and he was great at it. And then there was me, and I lived my life in books. I believe I've read every day of my life since I learned the alphabet. And, you know, I learned pretty quickly that I could fall in love with the people in those books and the places in those books, and I never had to tell them bye. Because, you see, in my real life, if I said hello to you, that meant I would have to say goodbye to you. And I did not like saying goodbye, so I learned pretty early on not to say hello very often. So I just lived in books. And that was my family. And we looked really good on the outside. If you saw us, you would say, boy, look at the Raley family. I just really think they're great. And we were okay, but, you know, under the roof of that house, we really lived on four different islands. Each one of us had our own island, and we just stayed on our islands, and we came together every night for supper because that was really important to my mom that we do that. And the rest of the time, we just lived on our individual islands. Of course, growing up in that family, there became a time that the opposite sex became quite attractive to me, and this is what he was like for me at that time. He was tall. He had dark hair. He'd walk in a room and people would say, oh, look, he's here, he's here. Everybody would be so glad to see him because he knew how to tell a story. He could tell some stories. He knew how to treat a woman when he was dating her. He knew the right things to say. He knew what to do. In addition, in my experience, he had either been physically and or sexually and or emotionally abused growing up. He physically and or sexually and or emotionally abused the women that he was involved with. He didn't know how to express any feelings well. He did express one anger in very inappropriate ways. He had not a clue how to handle conflict, not one clue in the world. And, you know, I realized years later that he was me. He was me. I was just like that myself. In addition, I would lie when it would be just as easy to tell the truth. Sometimes I would lie and I would think, why are you lying about that? There's no reason to lie. And I would just lie. I believed if you'd let me control the world and everybody in it, we would all be so much better off. I could manipulate with the best of them. You know, normal was kind of boring to me. So if I had normal for very long, I would just create some chaos. And I was so good at it, once the dust had settled and things had calmed down, you would be apologizing to me for the chaos that you had started. I could castrate or crucify you with the words that would come out of my mouth. I could talk you into a corner and hold you in that corner with my words until the only way you could get out would be to push or shove your way out. And boy, did I know how to make you feel guilty about that. Now, I'm not proud that that's who I am, but that is part of who I am. But fortunately, I found a transformative program that has changed everything about me. And most days now, I can stand before people as a woman of dignity and grace, and I can speak my truth in kindness and love. And I don't have to be that woman anymore, although she does still rear her head from time to time. And I have to make amends. I have to do what I need to do to rectify a situation and make it right. So, his wounded heart will call out to my tortured soul. And we would join hands together and we would walk off into the sunset to live happily ever after. And for me, it just never worked. It just didn't. Short-term relationships, short-term marriages, that's just the way my life was. Just the way it was. Fortunately for me and a lot of unsuspecting men in America, in 1978, I was living in a small town in South Alabama called Andalusia. I know you can't tell that I've ever lived in the South. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And it was about 15 minutes away in another small South Alabama town called Op, Alabama. And it was at a church. And we walked in the church and walked down a hall, and there was a lady standing in the doorway that I can see as well today as I saw her that night. Her name was Miss Ina, and it was 1978, so she had this tall, bouffant hairdo with curls everywhere. She had a royal blue silk dress on that belted around the waist. She had on black patent leather high heel shoes. She had her hose on. She had her jewelry on. And she held out her hand to me, and she said, "Honey, you come with me." And that was my first Al-Anon meeting. Now, I can't tell you one thing that was said that night. You know, sometimes great events happen in our lives, and we don't realize they're great events. And that's the way that night was for me. But I can tell you she gave me this One Day at a Time book, and I knew I was home. I knew I was home. She just patted my hand just about the whole meeting. On the way home that night, my friend that had taken me said, "Well, how did you like the meeting?" I said, "Oh, I loved it, but I don't think I can go back." And he said, "Why not?" And I said, "Well, I don't know any alcoholics." Now, please understand, by this time, I had been married to several alcoholics. All my great uncles were alcoholics. My favorite uncles were alcoholic. My favorite aunt was an alcoholic. My mother was an alcoholic. But you see, at that time, I did not associate their behaviors with the disease of alcoholism. And so my friend said, "Well, you know me," and I did know him. But I don't know how it was where you were in 1978, but in South Alabama in 1978, Al-Anon was made up of women who were married to the men that went to the AA meeting that met right next door in the next room at that same church at the same time. And that's not who I was. So while I identified strongly with the message, I didn't identify so much with the messengers. I'm so grateful today that Al-Anon is made up of all kinds of us, from all walks of life, all cultures, all everything. So anyway, I was in and out of Al-Anon for about 12 years. I would go a while, I'd get out a while. I'd go a while, I'd get out a while. I'd run out there and mess up another relationship and run back to Al-Anon and learn just enough to be a little more dangerous, and I'd run back out there again. Finally, June 15th, 1990, I said, "Angie, you are so blessed. Number one, you have found Al-Anon. You know, most people never find us." Lois Wilson was quite concerned about that. She was the co-founder of Al-Anon. She said, "You know, people will read about us in the newspapers. They'll read about us being arrested for alcohol-related accidents. They'll read about us being arrested for drinking. But how are they going to get the good news of recovery?" She said, "We are not a secret society. We are not a secret society. How will they get that good news?" I worry about that too sometimes. How do people get the good news? Well, I had gotten the good news. And number two, I could choose to stay. Most people that do find Al-Anon don't choose to stay. They come, they find out we don't have a magic pill that's going to cure their loved one, and they don't come back. Well, I had chosen to come back many times, and I could choose to stay. So June 15th, 1990, I chose to stay, and since that time, I've been a very active and continuing member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen, and it has changed everything in my life. Everything in my life is bigger and better and more awesome than I ever imagined it would be, because of the programs that I practice. May 18th, 1991, I woke up, and I decided to go see my daughter, who was the absolute best thing that had ever come out of my first marriage. Her name's Amanda, and anybody that I talk about in my story has given their approval for me to do that. So I had not heard from her in about 3 months. She was in college, and we were pretty close, so it was very unusual for me to go such a long stretch without hearing from her. But I've been back in Al-Anon now for about a year, and I'm trying to do the best I know how to do at the time with what I have to practice this program. So I was waiting on God to let me know what to do about Amanda. And when I woke up that morning, I knew it was time to go see her. So I called my two best friends. I said, "I'm going to see Amanda way up in North Alabama. You want to go? They said, yes, so we take off. On the way, one of my friends said, what are we going to do when we get there? And I said, you know, I don't know, but God's going to let us know what to do. And you know, there are times in my life, if I'm really working this program the way that I know I need to work my program, if I'm being of service to God and my fellows, if I'm trying to be as spiritually fit as I can, if I'm working with my sponsor, if I'm working with other people, sometimes God will just do for me what I can't do for myself. And that whole day was that kind of day. We got to Tuscaloosa. We got to the apartment complex where my daughter lived. We got out of the car. And there was a bank of mailboxes where everybody got their mail. And there was mail just scattered all over the ground. And we walked over and started picking up the mail, and it all had my daughter's name on it. So we gathered up the mail. We put it in the car. And I said, I'm going to go see what's going on. So we got the apartment. Nobody answered. I said, I'm going to go find the apartment manager and get him to come open up the apartment and let us see what's happening. So I did. One friend went with me, and we were going downstairs, and the other friend called out, and she said, Angie, she's here. And I turned around and looked, and Amanda was standing in the doorway. So I walked up to her, and I hugged her. And I said, Amanda, I love you, and it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. We walked inside, sat down, talked for a few minutes. And I said, Amanda, I know something's wrong. I don't know what it is, but I know there's something wrong. And I thought to myself, this is starting off good. And I said, I want you to know that I'm here today to make you an offer. And I remember thinking at the time, I wonder what the offer's going to be. I said, I'm here to do whatever I need to do to get you the help you need. I'm here to take you wherever I need to take you. I'm here to pay whatever I need to pay. I'm here to do whatever I need to do. Whatever it takes to get you whatever you need. And inside I'm thinking, this is good. This is really good. And then I said, but I want you to know the offer's only good for today. And I thought to myself, Angie, don't do this. Don't make this offer only good for today. I stood up. I said, I'm going to give you an hour to make up your mind. And I left. So I was gone for that hour, and I cried that whole hour because I knew when I got back, she was not going to have accepted the offer. I got back, I walked in, sat down, we talked for a few minutes, and she said, Mama, I accept your offer. And you know, my mind was just a blank. I had no idea what I was going to do. But a name came to me of a therapist way down in South Alabama. And for you young people that are here, we used to have a woman named Information. And her phone number was 411. And if you gave permission, you could give Information your phone number. And if somebody called and wanted your number, Information would give it to them. So I called Information, gave the lady's name. Information gave me her number. I called. She answered the phone on a Saturday afternoon. I told her a little bit about what was going on. By this time, Amanda had told me that she had written a few bad checks. So I told the therapist, she's written a few bad checks. The therapist said, well, you know, maybe she's got a mental illness. And I said, maybe she does. Because I knew a little bit about mental illness, and I thought, we'll get her some good therapy, maybe get her some medicine for a while, and she'll be okay. So we talked a little bit, and as a result of that, at 9 o'clock the next morning, I had my daughter at Providence Hospital in Mobile, Alabama. At that time, the hospital had a floor of their hospital, and half of it was for persons with mental illness, and half of it was for persons with drug and alcohol problems. So Amanda was admitted to the half of the floor for persons with mental illness. I met her psychiatrist, Dr. Thomas, who has since gone on to that great meeting in the sky. Dr. Thomas said, what do you think's wrong with your daughter? I said, I don't know. She's written a few bad checks. He said, maybe she's got a mental illness. I said, maybe she does. And I left her there. And Amanda stayed there for 2 months. And every weekend, I would go see her. And every weekend, she would tell me serious and dramatic things that had happened in her life that I didn't know anything about. But for me, the most serious and dramatic thing she told me was the day that she told me that she was an alcoholic. You see, I had been running from the disease of alcoholism and to the disease of alcoholism all of my life. And I knew I had a decision to make that day. Was I going to run from Amanda, or was I going to run to her? When I got home that day, I fell on my knees and I took step one in a way that I had never taken it before. I knew my life was unmanageable. I could see the unmanageability all around me. But I did not want to admit that I was powerless. I don't know why I did not want to give up that illusion of power, but I just didn't. But that day I did. I gave it up. The next Al-Anon meeting, I asked Debbie to be my sponsor, and we drove into the steps in a way I never had before. Step two was easy for me. I have always known my whole life that there was something greater than me in the universe, and I choose to call that something God. I've always known that. So step two wasn't hard. But you see, I tried to just live my life kind of under the radar of God, just skimming right along there, right under his view. Because I believed if God ever truly saw me, if he ever really saw me, I believed he would not want someone like me that had done the things that I had done to live on this beautiful earth that he had created. So I tried to just skim along there under his sight. So when I got to step three, that was a little harder. Because now I'm asked to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God that I've been trying to hide from. But I figured out a way to do that. I said, I'm going to do that. I'm going to turn my will and my life over one day. I'll do that one day. I'm so grateful for a strong arm of my Al-Anon lineage that goes like this. It started with Lois Wilson. Then it went to Arbutuson, Texas. It went to a couple of other ladies in Arkansas, and then to a lady named Lou Bell in Arkansas, who was the wife of Charlie, of Joe and Charlie fame. And then it went from Lou Bell to Mary Pearl, from Mary Pearl to Debbie in Devil, Alabama, and from Debbie to me. And when Arbutus was spreading the good news of Al-Anon in Texas, at that time all they had was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 and 12. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for allowing us and over 100 other types of anonymous programs to use that literature. Because that's what we had. As our wonderful Al-Anon literature has been published and developed, all our pamphlets, all our books, we use all of that literature in our lineage, and I'm so happy that we have it. But we've also always used those foundational texts. So when I got to step three, I worked step three the first time the way Debbie had worked them with her sponsor. I had a packet. I had all kind of stuff to read. I had a bunch of stuff to look at and 12 questions to answer for each step. So I met Debbie at the clubhouse and did my 12 questions, and I never told her I was adding on to that step. One day. I'll do it one day. So when we finished, Debbie said, okay, when you get up in the morning, you'll say the third step prayer, and you'll say it every day the rest of your life. And when we got to seven, she added that on as well. So the next morning when I got up, I had to say that prayer. And as you know, it starts off, God, I offer myself to thee. And it wasn't one day. It wasn't one day. It was right then. Right then. And I knew God was seeing me. I knew he was. There was a while I would say that prayer, and I would just sob every day when I said it, because I truly believed he was just going to kill me. I really did. But you see, that's where I was. I was willing to do whatever Debbie suggested I do. There came a time I quit crying when I said those prayers, although I still do get misty-eyed sometimes when I say them. Sometimes I sing them today. Sometimes I sing them, and at the end I say, God, what mission have you got for us today? Let's get on with it. Let's get on with it. When I finished step three that day, Debbie handed me a package. She said, this is your four-step inventory. And it was 30 pages front and back, single space, question after question after question after question about my life. The same inventory that she had done with her sponsor. Well, I always met with Debbie right before the Al-Anon meeting, so I go over there to my spot, and I'm going through those pages, and I'm already bargaining with God. Because, you see, there's something I had never told. And I knew I didn't have to tell it. I had always rationalized and justified why I didn't have to tell it, and I knew I didn't. But just in case I did, I'm bargaining with God, and I'm telling God, now, God, if I'm supposed to tell Debbie this, it's going to be in here. And there's going to be a sentence, and the sentence is going to say exactly, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's not going to say da-da-da-da-da-da or da-da-da. It's going to say the exact words, God, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And only if it does do I have to tell Debbie. Well, thank goodness, about three-fourths of the way through that packet, about halfway down that page, there was the sentence, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I said, oh, I'm going to have to tell her. I'm going to have to tell her. The day I did step five, I made sure I got to the clubhouse first. I watched Debbie drive up. I watched her get out of the car. I watched her come up to me. Because I knew when we got to that question, our relationship was going to change. We went inside, sat down, and dove in. She would ask the question. I would answer the question. We got to that question. She asked it. I answered it. I started crying. Down, and she came over and stood behind me, and she just hugged me, and I felt something on top of my head, and it was her tears. She was crying with me, and in that instant, the shame and the guilt that I felt about what I had done was gone. Now, I still felt responsible. I need to feel responsible for every action and behavior in my life, but the shame and the guilt were just killing me, and it was gone. It was just gone. You know, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that day that Debbie loved me. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that day that God loved me. And neither of those things were what I expected to come out of doing step five. My relationship with Debbie did change. We left that room closer than we were when we had walked in that room. And that was step five for me. Step six and seven, I did the way I think many people do. I did each step. I met Debbie at the clubhouse, went over the questions, went somewhere quiet for an hour, and then I just kind of waited for God to do whatever he was going to do with me. Well, I've learned over the years that that's just not the kind of God I have. My God expects me to do my part. If I do my part, God always does his. But I'm expected to do my part. And there have been three books over the years that have really helped me understand what my part is. Those three books are Drop the Rock, Drop the Rock, The Ripple Effect, which is the sequel, and Steps and Stories by Sandy Beach. Those three books have opened up steps six and seven to me in a way that nothing else had ever done before. You know, one time, several years ago, Chip and I went to the World Service Office of Al-Anon in Virginia Beach. And we toured and we got to meet a lot of all the staff, I think, that was there that day. We got to meet a lot of staff, and I had some questions that I wanted answered. Because there'd been a lot of, you know, for programs that don't have controversy, sometimes we do. And so there was controversy in the Al-Anon world, there still is today, about what you can read. And as a reader, that was important to me. So that was one of my questions. So I asked the staff, what can I read? And you know what they told me? They said, Angie, you can read anything you want to read. You can read any book. You can talk about any book from a podium, in a meeting, wherever you want to. You can have book studies at your house. You can go to 12-step things. You can do whatever you want to do. We just ask at your regular, not a specialty meeting, just at your regular Al-Anon meeting, you can find most of your comments, that's 51%, most of your comments, to conference-approved literature. And I said, well, I do that. And I can do that, and I will do that, because I have people come to our meeting, they only get 1 hour of Al-Anon a week, and I want them to get really good Al-Anon when they come. But thank you for saying I can read and study and learn whatever I choose to read and study and learn, because that has certainly expanded my recovery life. It really has. So those three books are really important to me. As I said, Amanda stayed in that treatment center 2 months. The day that she admitted she was alcoholic, they just packed up her belongings and they moved her from the side of the unit for persons with a mental illness to the side of the unit for persons with alcohol and drug problems. Wasn't that great? Wasn't that just great? So when I went to pick her up, I had a contract for her to look at. Now, I had written the contract because I come from a long line of martyrs. Woe is me. I can't believe what you're doing to me. How could you do this to me after all I've done for you? Blah, 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 you know. And I did not want to be a martyr anymore. So the contract was for me, to keep things even so I couldn't martyr over my daughter. And the contract said things like, she agreed not to have men come and spend the night in our home. I agreed not to have men spend the night in our home. If she wanted to come stay with me for a while till she could get on her feet, I would buy groceries. She'd cook 3 nights a week. She could use my car sometime because she didn't have one then. She had to keep it clean and detailed. She could stay with me for a while. She had to pay me $100 a month rent. You see, for everything I agreed to do, she agreed to do something. So it would keep things even. And I had been through all that mail that was on the ground and had learned that Amanda was facing at least 15 years at Tutwiler Prison for Women in Alabama because of the amount of bad checks she had written. There were more than just a few. So I had paid all that off. But the contract said she had 10 years to pay me back or she would go to Tutwiler Prison for Women in Alabama. She paid the money back in 8 years. Now, if she was here today, she would tell you she looked at that contract and she thought, prison or mama? Prison or mama? Well, she picked mama. She signed the contract. I signed the contract. And we went home to learn how to be a family in recovery. And I want to mention right here about that contract. You know, the contract was just a piece of paper. It's just a piece of paper. The contract wasn't important because it was a piece of paper. It was important because if I would enforce it or not. I always tell people, don't do anything like that if you're not willing to follow through. Because, you know, I had learned in my life, I used to think I was so sanctimonious and holier than thou. And I probably lied more than my daughter did. Because every time I would say to her, if you do that one more time, next time you do this, when you do this again, and I didn't do whatever it was. I just lied and lied and lied. So I knew when I did that contract, I was going to have to enforce it. So we go home. We start learning how to be a family in recovery. Amanda's been living with me several months, and she comes home one day, and she says, Mama, you know I'm doing everything you've wanted me to do. I'm working hard. I got a sponsor. I'm doing the steps. I've got 6 part-time jobs. I'm going here. I'm going there. I'm cooking. I'm cleaning. I'm keeping your car done. I'm doing everything, Mama, but I just don't think I'm going to have the rent money tomorrow. But I'm doing everything else you wanted me to do, and I'm working so hard. And I said, Amanda, you are absolutely right. You have done everything that I've asked you to do and more. And I hope you are so proud of yourself. And it's okay if you don't have the rent money when I come home tomorrow. Because, you see, before you came here and stayed with me, I went and talked with the Salvation Army here in town. And they told me anytime I needed to, I could drop you off, and they'd give you 2 hots and a cot. So when I get home tomorrow, if the rent money's not on the table, that's okay. I'm still going to love you. I'm still going to be your mother. We'll still do things together. But we're going to pack your stuff up, and I'm going to drop you off at the Salvation Army, and you'll never live with me again. And anything you want, you better take, because whatever you leave here is going to be mine. Well, y'all, you can imagine. Her eyes were as big as dinner plates. I went in the bathroom and got in the shower, my favorite place to cry, and I just boo-hooed. Because I knew I could do that. I knew I could. You see, there had been some times in Amanda's life that I would say something to her that I wouldn't say to the checkout clerk at the grocery store. There'd been some times in her life that I'd used a tone of voice that I wouldn't use with the teller at the bank. There'd been some times in her life that I'd shrug my shoulders or roll my eyes or did other kind of offensive gestures that I wouldn't do to a stranger that I'm sitting next to on a plane. And I really believe that day that those days were pretty much over, because I could finally see my daughter as a human being that deserved respect and dignity. And if any of us in this room had a contract with each other and one of us broke it, there would be consequences for that. That's just the way the world works. That's just how it is. And Amanda deserved that same respect that any of us would get. This lady came up to me one time and she said, well, your daughter might deserve respect, but my son doesn't. He's stolen from us and vomited in our car, and he stole our car, and he's done all this stuff. And I said, no, ma'am, you're just wrong. I said, your son deserves respect and dignity, if for no other reason than just because he's a precious, precious child of God. And I said, and my daughter deserved that too. I got home the next day, the rent money was on the table, and it was there every month until Amanda moved out. Another thing I started learning that year that I still learn today goes like this. If my name is not in the sentence, it is none of my business. And this is how that works. Sometimes I would say something to Debbie like, boy, I wonder if Amanda's going to her meetings. And Debbie would say, Angie, your name is not in that sentence. So then I would say, boy, I wonder if Amanda, Angie's daughter, is going to her meetings. Debbie'd laugh. She'd say, you cannot do that. Your name is not in that sentence. Here's other sentences that don't have my name. Does Amanda have a sponsor? Is Amanda working the steps? Is Amanda being a good home group member? And as the years have gone on, is Amanda being a wonderful wife? Is Amanda being a kind mother? Is Amanda being an upstanding citizen? Is Amanda being a woman of dignity and grace and speaking her truth and kindness and love and on and on and on? My name is in none of those sentences. But here are some sentences that do have my name. Is Angie going to her meeting? Does Angie have a sponsor? Is Angie being of service to God and her fellows? Is Angie being a good home group member? Is Angie being a kind wife, a loyal mother, an awesome grandmother? Is Angie being an upstanding citizen? Is Angie being a woman of dignity and grace and speaking her truth and kindness and love and on and on? I learned that my name was in enough sentences. I really didn't have a lot of time left over to worry about those sentences that didn't have my name. Amanda celebrated 32 years in Alcoholics Anonymous last year, thanks to the program that she works, thanks to people just like you that have walked every step of the way with her, the God of her understanding. She has a wonderful husband named Gary that is just a regular fella. He's probably the only regular fella in our family. We all love him. I have 2 grandchildren, Annabelle and Kip, that are just a delight. And Amanda and I love each other. We love each other. We're always going to be mother and daughter. But we love each other, and we support each other, and we care about each other. My mother never did get in recovery. The last couple years of her life, she had COPD and emphysema such that she could no longer go get in the car and go drive and buy alcohol, so she did not drink alcohol, but she was not in recovery. And for most of that 2-year period of time, she lived with me 2 or 3 weeks out of the month, and then she lived with my daughter 2 weeks out of the month because I travel some those 2 weeks. And then 3 weekends out of 4, I would take her to her home so she could be at her home. I never could have done any of that without the rooms of Al-Anon and Open AA. You see, I didn't learn how to be a loving daughter only from a one-hour Al-Anon meeting a week. That was important, but that's not how I learned it. I learned it from getting in the car and going and being with people in recovery. Debbie said to me when I got in recovery, she said, Angie, you have the family disease of alcoholism. You better learn everything you can about it. So we got in the car and we went. Us Al-Anons, if we're lucky, we have one convention a year, one district picnic, and one workshop. But the AA folks are doing stuff all the time, and most of it is with Al-Anon participation. So we went and we did. We would rent a house on the lake, and there'd be 35 or 40 of us. You wouldn't know who was AA or who was Al-Anon. We'd have a 12-step weekend, or we'd have a promise weekend, or we'd have some kind of weekend. We were going to conferences and conventions and whoopee parties, and all the time I was seeing how you related to each other. I was seeing how conflict got settled. I was seeing how people talked with each other. I learned that a man could love me, just love me to pieces and not want to have sex with me. I learned that I could love a man and he wouldn't expect sex from me. I learned to love women. When I came in recovery, I did not like women at all. I learned to love women. I learned how to relate to people and how to be, and I learned how to be a loving daughter. So when I needed to step up for my mother, I was able to do that, thanks to folks just like you. One day my mom was sitting on the couch at my house, and out of the blue she said, I know you talk about me when you speak. And at that time, I really didn't. And I said, no, ma'am, I don't. And she said, well, I know you do. And I said, no, ma'am, I don't talk about you when I speak. And then she said, I know you talk about when I used to beat you. And, you know, I never talked about that to anybody. So I said, no, I do not talk about that. She said, I know you do. I said, no, ma'am, I don't. And then she said what I think was her attempt at making amends to me. She said, well, you know, I didn't beat you every day. And I thought, oh, my goodness, we are here. So I looked at her and I said, no, ma'am, you didn't beat me every day, but you beat me many days. And one day was one day too many. And then I went over and I knelt down in front of my mother, and I said to her and was able to see her the way I heard a speaker talk about one time when the speaker said she believed God allowed her to see her mother the way God saw her mother. And that's how I saw my mom that day. She'd always been 60 feet tall to me. And that day, she was this little, tiny, shriveled up, 82-year-old woman sitting on the couch in the middle of the day with her pajamas on. She had the oxygen tubes in her nose. She was tethered to this big machine for the rest of her life. Her hair was a little bit disheveled. She was scared. She was frightened. She was alone. She's a woman that had lived most of her life behind a 10-foot concrete wall that nothing could get in and nothing could get out. She was stoic. She was strong. She was hard. She also was a fantastic Army officer's wife. She could throw the best parties that anybody ever threw. She was elegant. She was beautiful. She was tall. She was attractive. She was statuesque. She was fun when she wanted to be fun. She could be whatever she wanted to be. And she was also an alcoholic who beat me. So I knelt in front of her and I said, Mom, I want you to know that I have forgiven you. And that's why I tell this story. I said, remember that day I came and talked with you about things that I had done to you and how I had hurt you? Steps 8 and 9. She said, oh, yeah, I remember. I said, well, I had already forgiven you that day, and I'm so sorry I didn't tell you. You see, when I got to step 8 and I made my list, Debbie said, we've got some work to do here. She said, yes, you have done things that have harmed these people, but a lot of these people have harmed you. And she said, before you can go make amends, you've got to work on forgiveness so that when you do go, you'll go with a heart full of nothing but love and caring for them, so that no matter what they say or what they do, it's not going to matter. Because you will have done your part in love and care. And so I had worked on forgiving my mother for a while before I ever went and made amends to her. But you see, I didn't tell her. So I told her that day. I said, Mom, I forgive you. And I said, and I love you so much. And we hugged each other and we cried together. And I think it was probably the second time in my life I ever saw my mother cry. I know that day my mom gained a new level of freedom. And I know that day I gained a new level of freedom as well. In 2006, I was doing a 10-step inventory, and I was looking at my whole part of life that had to do with male-female relationships, and I realized I had never turned over to God that part of my life. I don't know why. By now, the wreckage is up to my nose. I'm just wrecking through relationships, you know, but I'm still thinking I can do it better than God. Finally, that day, I said, I surrender. I can't do this. I just can't do it. I've never been able to do it. I don't know how to do it. I'm just done. I'm going to stop looking for men. I'm going to start hunting them down when I go places. I'm just going to learn how to be a happy, joyous, and free single woman in recovery. And God, if you ever see fit to put anybody in my life, you're going to have to put them there and keep them there because I'm not going to be looking. And I looked at my spiritual life. I looked at step 11. You know, God was a big kahuna in the sky to me. And I wanted him to be this big kahuna up there. But I also wanted him to be my best friend, and he wasn't. He was up there in the sky, which I wanted him to be, but I wanted him to be down here on earth too. I wanted him to be walking down the street with me. I wanted him to be in the bathroom with me. I wanted him to be at dinner with me. I wanted him to be everywhere I went. And I wanted to be able to talk to him, just like I'm talking right now. And I didn't have that kind of relationship with God. So I said, I got to work on this too. So I did some things in my spiritual life. I changed some things up. I got in therapy because I wanted to start clearing away the wreckage of the past and looking at how I had gotten there, what was going to happen. And I went on this journey. And it was an 8-year journey. Now, I didn't know when I started it that it was going to be an 8-year journey. I didn't know I was going to be turning down dates and not dating for 8 years. This young girl came up to me one time. She said, oh, my God, Miss Angie, are you telling me I can't date for 8 years? I said, no, honey, I'm not telling you that. I said, I don't know how much wreckage you've got. I had a lot of wreckage to go through. But I am saying this, don't settle. Don't settle. We know when we're settling. We feel that little nudge. We hear that little soft voice. I settled about all kinds of things. I settled about relationships. I settled about jobs. I settled about where I was going to live. Just don't settle, you know? So I went on this 8-year journey. And March the 8th of 2014, I was going to the Flint River Roundup in Albany, Georgia. I was going to host Bo T. He was a good friend of mine. And I'm just talking away to God because, you see, now God is my best friend. And I just talked to him, but just like I'm talking right now. So I'm just talking to God and getting ready to go. And as I was leaving the house, I said, God, I just want you to know that I have done everything you've wanted me to do, and I'm ready. And I shocked myself. I got to Albany. I was kind of emotional on that trip over. I was rooming with a friend of mine named Jean. Jean still remembers that day. She remembers when I walked in the room that day because she said something was different about me. When I walked in, she said, what's happened? So I told her, I said, I was just doing all this stuff. And I said, Jean, I just told God. I just want you to know I've done everything you've wanted me to do, and I'm ready. And then I said, because I have that kind of God today, I said, let's see how long it takes God. Well, as Chip mentioned last night, we have a picture on our refrigerator at home that our daughter Amanda made. Less than 24 hours later, when a 14-year acquaintanceship friendship started to change. I guess 14 years of him being in front of me was long enough. 6 months later, we were married. And I've had my first ever, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, the ninth wedding anniversaries. And, you know, marriage is just pretty good. It is pretty good. We've had a lot of fun. When we got married, my sponsor said, well, Chip had 26 years in AA, and I had 24 years in Al-Anon. She said, this marriage is starting off with 50 years. Maybe it has a chance. Maybe it has a chance. And it has had a chance, and we've had a wonderful time. We have a wonderful life with a lot of fun. It's got a lot to do with recovery, and we love every second of it, every second of it. So that brings me to step 12. I have had a spiritual awakening. Now what do I do with it now that I've had it? And so I want to talk in my time left here a little bit about what I do with that spiritual awakening that I've had. In 2014, Chip and I were at the Gulf Shores Jubilee in Gulf Shores, Alabama, and we were in the food line. And it was Chip and me and a friend of ours named John. John is a dear friend of my daughter's and was a dear friend of my daughter's, and we had met John through her. And at that time, John was, I think, in his mid-30s, and he had 4 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so we're talking in the food line. And so, we're like you do. And so I said, how's it going? And so he's telling me, and he got real emotional. He said, I'm working on step 9. And he said, I want to make amends to my parents, but I can't. His father had died when he was 9, and his mother died when he was 28. And he said, I'm just struggling so hard here because I really want to do that, but I don't know how. Well, I have kind of a standard thing I say when somebody says something like that, that they want to make amends to somebody that has passed on. But, you know, I felt that little nudge that day, and I paid attention to it. So I looked at John, and I said, well, John, we're standing right here. And so John looked at me, and he looked at Chip, and he said, oh, my God, would y'all be my parents? And Chip and I looked at each other, and we said, yes. So we're all standing there in the food line. The three of us are crying, and we became a family that day. We became a family. And recently we celebrated 10 years of John being our son. And it has been wonderful. It has been a wonderful ride. John had always wanted to work at the beach, and he got a fantastic job in Destin where we live. And he came down and he lived with us for a little over 6 months while he was getting on his feet and looking for a place to live. And he would come home every night and I'd have dinner ready, just like my mother did for me. And he came home one night and he said, you know, I can't remember the last time I came home to family. And I said, I can't remember the last time family came home to us like this every day, because it had been a long time since Amanda had lived with us on a regular basis. One night we were talking and he said, you know, my parents loved me so good, but they didn't know all of who I am. And he said, you and Chip know all of who I am, and you love me so good. And I knew when he said that why that day in that food line, I paid attention to that little nudge. We have a great time. We all get together for holidays. I mean, he's just part of our family, just like our daughter is. And it's been wonderful. It's been a wonderful experience for all of us that we never would have gotten to have otherwise. About 8 years ago, I realized that I was saying things on social media that a woman of dignity and grace does not need to be saying. I was getting in arguments with people. I was fussing and cussing and getting upset. And I was in a bad way. And my sponsor's not on social media, so she didn't know. But I have sponsees that are on social media, and they did know. So finally, I called up Mary Beth, my sponsor today. I called her up, and I confessed, and I told her what I'd been doing. And she said, oh, my God, Angie. I said, I know. Tell me about it. She said, we've got some work to do here. She said, we've got to look at causes and conditions and what we're going to do about it. Well, what we're going to do about it was pretty simple. I had to go on Social Media World, every platform that I used, and make amends, and I did. I went on Social Media World. I said who I was, that I was saying things and doing things that a woman of dignity and grace didn't need to be saying and doing on social media. Here was all my contact information. If I had done anything that offended or harmed anybody in any way, please contact me. I'm going to do everything I can to make that right. And I made a commitment that day to only be a woman of dignity and grace, the best that I absolutely could on social media, and I've kept that commitment. Then we looked at what had gotten me there. And what had gotten me there was I was living once again in a place of fear that I had not lived in many, many years. You know, for most of my life before recovery, everything I did was based on fear. The decisions I made was based on fear. Where I lived was based on fear. What I did was based on fear. But once I got in recovery and I started working the steps, at some point, the fear just went away. I didn't say I'm going to work on fear. It was just through working the steps. I can still remember the day I was in my car, and it struck me that I wasn't afraid. So I really realized it by the absence of fear rather than the presence of fear. I just realized I wasn't afraid anymore. Well, it was back. And what I learned in that experience was, for me, always under my fear is a lack of faith and trust in God. So I had to ramp up my spiritual life. I started doing some things different there. And when I did, the fear went away again and it has not come back. And I believe if I will stay spiritually fit, that I won't have to worry about that fear again. But that was an experience that I had to go through and see from a simple thing that a lot of people were doing at the time on social media. But this woman of dignity and grace can't do. Probably a couple years ago now, I was watching the news one night. And in the middle of the newscast, I just sat up and I said, oh my goodness, I can't. And I have to say, the news was pretty bad that night. And they were talking about all these people doing all this stuff to all these other people in all these ways, you know. And I sat up and I said, oh my goodness, I can't believe God loves every one of these people that newscaster's talking about as much as he loves me. I don't have any ego, do I? How could God love all those people as much as he loves me? And I went on this rant at God. How could God love all these people doing all this stuff like he loved me? I was so angry at God. I stayed angry at God for weeks. I inventoried it. I talked to my sponsor about it. I was just mad. I was so mad at God. And I finally got to what I knew was a crossroads for me, and I had a decision to make. Was I going to believe in an all-encompassing God of love? Or was I going to believe in a little bitty God that looked like me, walked like me, talked like me, voted like me, acted like me? What was it going to be? What kind of God did I want to have? Well, I knew what the decision needed to be, so I stayed mad at God about another week, and I finally said, I want that all-encompassing God of love. And this is what that means for me. It means that I believe God expects me to find one grain of sand in common, if that's what it takes. And you know, if you live at the beach, trying to find one grain of sand in common is a tall order. But I believe when I got in recovery, that's what I've been charged to do. You know, I've been thinking lately about what does it mean to be a program of attraction and not promotion? What is the program of attraction? The program of attraction is not the meetings, because most people never go to a meeting. The program of attraction is not our literature, because most people never read the literature. What is the program of attraction? And I believe it's us. I believe we are the program of attraction. So the lady that usually waits on me at Starbucks, if she comes to my meeting Monday night and she walks in and sees me sitting there, what is she going to think about Al-Anon? What is she going to think about recovery? I'm about the only person in my family that has an Al-Anon program and works it. What does my family think about Al-Anon? I can tell you some of them don't like it much, but that may not be a bad thing. But what are they going to think about Al-Anon when they see me and when they're around me? You know, what does it mean to be in recovery? I think when we come into these rooms, we're held to a higher standard. I believe I sure am with sponsees. And, you know, the higher standard with my sponsees is to be real, to let them know when I mess up, to let them know when I fess up, when I got to make an amends, when I have to do things. Because I want them to see real recovery, and I want to be a part of real recovery, real recovery. This is the most fabulous journey that I've ever been on in my life. And I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunity to get on it and to be on it. And now it's up to me to spread the message. You know, sometimes I see people walking into our meeting and I think, do they look happy to be here? Do they look like this is the best thing that's happened to them all week? You know, what kind of program of attraction are we? You know, we're very blessed while we've been here this weekend. There are people around the country that are doing what we're doing. We've kind of opened back up from COVID and gotten back on our feet. I do want to mention real quick, I do go to 2 Zoom meetings a week that I've been going to now for over 4 years. They're just as much a part of my life as my face-to-face meeting is. I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to do that. When Zoom first happened, I was one of those that says, I'm not going to do that. Well, I can tell you, it sure saved me during COVID for sure. And it continues to do that, because I go to meetings with some great folks that I couldn't do otherwise. So while we've been here, there have been people all over the world that are doing this kind of stuff. We're sharing our language of the heart with each other. You let me do that this morning, and I hope I have an opportunity to hear your language of the heart too. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Angie. Just an incredible story. I'm so glad.